Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today my guest is Sees Notaboom. He's the author, most recently, of All Souls Days, published by Harkert. He has been a friend to Bookworm since its early days, when I read his novel, which won the European Literature Award, The Following Story. He's the author of a travel book about Spain and the pilgrimage Roads to Santiago. His novels include Philip and the Others, In the Dutch Mountains, The Night Has Died, A Song of Truth and Semblance. And I'm always happy to see Sees Notaboom because he is a philosophical writer, I would say a genius of sorts, who in previous books has managed through a process of inhuman compression to create fables and allegories of our time. I've had the pleasure of discussing Sees's books with readers when I've been asked would I discuss books with a group of people. I've often chosen one of his because they provide perfect examples of an intersection of literature, philosophy, storytelling, fable, and truly a European experience. His new book, All Souls Day, is his longest novel. It's his most philosophical novel. What fascinated me about it is that it wants to be, in a sense, a book that takes place in the head and reveals what people do not say, the things that we do not know about them, that are not presented. Necessarily, therefore, the narrator is a documentary filmmaker. Not exactly narrator, the hero is a documentary filmmaker. He has traveled from crisis to crisis, although he would rather do a documentary about the life of Walter Benjamin. He is sent to hot spots and places where terrorism and action define what he will be shooting. He, therefore, is looking for the things in the world that go without saying, that can be seen almost by accident. The things that are always there have come to interest him, especially since 10 years ago his wife and child were killed in an airplane crash. Now, I wanted to begin by asking you, Sees, to write a novel when really your books have found a way almost to continuously reveal through action. This is a book in which meditation and poetry are the primary processes, and it would seem to be, especially given your earlier work, a very difficult book to construct.
And no, not really. I never, with any of my books, have had a premeditated plan. This book somehow, it wasn't easy to write, that's something else, but Berlin partly wrote this book, the city of Berlin. I was invited to Berlin in 89, and that was a very severe winter, but it was also the winter of the wall coming down. And in those days, I wrote a diary, not for myself, but a public diary, about all the things happening, you know, East Germans, etc., coming into freedom and everything around, and about Germany and German history, which to the Dutch is always some subject because of the war. And writing this diary, one has to think a lot about history, because all these things, you know, if you think of the last century, if you would have been a German, good or bad, if you were old enough, you would have lived through five regimes, you know, the Empire, the Revolution afterwards, the Republic of Weimar, Fascism, Second World War, Communism, and in the end then reunification. It's quite something, and you feel this. And if you have a certain mind, then you can't escape this. You can't be in Berlin without realizing all these things. And I was greatly helped by the fact that I was invited, strangely enough, to come to California. So in sunny California, I wrote this book about wintry Berlin. But it helped. I couldn't have done it there. I had to be somewhere completely different. And I felt like inside living in a cocoon in Berlin, and outside I was very happy to be in California.
Now, the book is largely concerned with a subject that has become almost de rigueur in American fiction, the subject of grief and mourning. Mm-hmm. If you happen to watch an Oprah Winfrey program, you will inevitably find a book, and inside the novel will be instructions for how to recover from grief. This man, Artur, yes, has his wife and child have died. He is Dutch, as is my guest, Sees Noteboom. He is living in Berlin. He has friends, a sculptor, a philosopher, a physicist. They get together to discuss the subjects of history and grief, and to one's enormous pleasure, we hear over dinners largely constructed out of sausages. At one point, they are demolishing a cathedral of sausage. The subject of grief and philosophy. They talk about being unto death, Heidegger's idea. In other words, the reader of this book is going to see how the intellectual confronts grief, and all of them are vaguely aware still that conceptualizing is not a solution to the problem, but it is something of a band-aid.
This, though, does not make for, let us say, gloomy discussions. No, these discussions are with a certain, how would you say this in English, alegría.
Animation.
Animation. They are eating and drinking. But still, they all know that he, every time, comes back from a mission. Because since his wife and child have died, television, not only German television, but also CNN, uses him, because he has no family responsibilities, uses him for the really awful things like minefields and mass graves even. And he has to film all these things. And so he brings with him and around him an aura of this secret knowledge of these things that we see on television for 2 seconds or 2 minutes, and that's about it, without ever we thinking about that somebody has to film this. Somebody's actually there. Somebody is, and sometimes somebody gets killed also in Afghanistan or in other conflicts. And so I think not out of some unpleasant curiosity, no, where they are the philosophers, one could say, and one is the artist, he is the man with the actual experience. And they form a rather strange quartet of, yes, well, sadness and animation, as you say. Yeah.
And learning.
And learning, yes.
Because one of the pleasures, it seems to me, of the book is that these are people of an earlier generation. I say an earlier generation because there is a young woman there. Her stance is to find sadness hilarious. She has the younger person's recourse to calling everything comedy. And for the others, it is not comedy. They are reviewing, in a sense, everything they know in order to find the things that will be useful to them to sustain them through a huge cultural change.
Well, they are very much occupied, I would say, with human suffering. One of the themes of the book, because in the end, this young person goes to Spain because she's an historian or an historian to be, and therefrom result discussions on what history really is, because her theme is a medieval theme, and his theme of the cameraman is actual history, and what remains of that. And so he's taking her, for example, as one moment that he takes her, in order to be instructive to her, to a certain place north of the city of Berlin, where once the wall was. And he vividly remembers, because he's been filming out there, that there was the wall, and then there was this passage of about 20 meters where if you tried to cross, you were shot immediately. And he remembers the guards with their binoculars, and he remembers all that. And now it's all gone. The little road is gone, the wall is gone, the Todesstreifen, that's the stretch where you would be shot, all that is disappeared, the watchtowers, even the men with their binoculars, all is disappears, and there's just a meadow. Now, where is history? Where are the visible signs? So the signs are within the people.
You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm speaking to Sees Noteboom about his novel All Souls Day, published by Harcourt. I want listeners to know how to spell this author's name. Sees, C-E-E-S, it would be in English Caesar, Noteboom, N-O-O-T-E-B-O-O-M, I believe nut tree, yes?
It is, yes. So. Walnut tree.
Now, what I found profoundly moving is that the central figure, Artur Dana, is that
right? Yes, perfect.
He believes that there are things that last, that are residues of what is human, and that in the wake of history and tragedy, we barely notice these things anymore. He is a documentarian, and he begins to assemble fragments of a counter-documentary of the things that we do not see that are human and permanent. They are photographs of feet moving across a snowy field, leaving prints behind them, birds jumping, almost a poem of what no longer gets noticed in the wake of the horrifying world. And he is hard-pressed to create a structure for such a work of art, and yet it comes to seem, at least, that this novel is the recording angel of these tragedies and these trivialities that make for the human in our time. Am I correct in thinking that way?
Well, if that is true, I would be very happy. What he wants, really, I think you've summed it up, but still, in my own words, he's forced to see the horrors of this world. That is his work. And he's afraid of the aestheticism of it. If you film a mass grave, you're still trying as a cameraman to do the best you can. And but whenever he comes back from all these things that hit him profoundly, he notices. So he's been filming the historical world. Now, what about the non-historical world? What about the trees? What about a certain reflect of sunlight in the water? What about, as you say, passing feet on the stairs of a subway? What about some clouds? What about flowers? So, secretly, every time that he's free, he's filming these things in the best possible way, of course. And his dream, and whether he will achieve that is open, but his dream is to combine our, let's say, suffering historical world with the anonymous world that we do not really pay attention.
Now, the woman, if I may venture interpretation here, Elik,
yes,
is her name. Artur becomes fascinated by the anger in her eyes, and he begins to follow her. They develop a relationship, but she seems to be a figure in the book that suggests that what we know of the past is no longer adequate. The history she's writing is about a Spanish queen, the only female medieval ruler. It's not exactly gender theory that she's operating according to. It's really looking, once again, for a counter-history in the same way that the hero is thinking of a counter-documentary. But her work involves, in a sense, the history of the unknown, the history that is not part of our parlance, in a way.
True. That special kingdom, I mean, the woman she's preoccupied with, that is the theme of her thesis, has actually lived, and she was Queen Urraca of Asturias y León, which is the northwestern corner of Spain. And from there, from that particular corner, the Reconquista, the how do you call that in English, the reconquering of Spain on the Muslims started in a few centuries earlier. Anyway, she is she finds an identification in this woman that not so much is known of, except that one knows that she has lived and that she, well, in a way, fought a battle against her own husband. And so this young woman, who is wounded in her own way, has really found a subject. But of course, the let's say her promoter at the university, they all think, well, why this queen and why this? This is such an unknown corner of Spanish history. Why should she be preoccupied with it? But she's very, very determined. She's going to do this. And in the personal relationship between these two people, one is wounded because he has lost wife and child, and the other one is wounded because some terrible things have happened to her in her youth. And they really, in a sense, are meant for each other, and they can't reach each other. This is the personal tragedy about. And then they have these two very different viewpoints on history. She says he has the male idea about a philosophy of history, you know, a grand design, and she wants to be preoccupied with little historical details. She says the historian's task is to find out as much as you can from the documents, and all these grand ideas are male ideas, and so she will do her own thing in that particular corner of Spanish history.
Now, these two wounded characters are meeting in a wounded country, and the place where the wall had been is repeatedly referred to in the novel All Souls Day by my guest Cees Notenboom as a scar. There's a scar running through the center of Berlin. And as you can begin to see in this novel, there are human scars, historical scars, and divisions between body and soul, between twins. There are two twins in the novel. One is rather silent, the other is rather emotional. Oppositions keep forming between people who are in fact very close to one another, but who have stopped being able to communicate. And one of the things that stops them from communicating is the very thing that draws them together. As one reads this book and one sees the Dutch in Germany speaking of Spanish art, one gets the sense that the vast multiplicity of intellect has made it still harder for them to reach common grounds and speak about simple things like death, like grief, like mourning. So the book becomes almost seditiously an intellectual comedy about how the best minds fail through mind to meet one another. Yes?
You could say, but it's, you know, how would minds meet? How can one convey very special feelings of grief? Like, I have lived the war, I could say. I've been passing the wall in the times that was really difficult. You had to queue, and then you entered East Berlin with all the menace that it represented. And then I remember when I was living here in Los Angeles, maybe this is not the right answer to your question, but still I'd like to tell this. I was invited by this university, Marymount, the
Royal
Jesuit.
Marymount, yes.
Yes. They had acquired a piece of the wall. And the wall stands there on campus. And I was invited there to come and speak. And then I saw, in the middle of sunny California, I saw this piece of concrete standing there.
Amazing.
And suddenly it lost all its menace. And then I saw all these nice young students around, and I thought, how can I convey what a terrible thing this was in the lives of so many people and for such a long period? How can you tell anything like that about grief and about sadness?
I wanted the listener to hear something of both the tearful and the light tone of this novel, All Souls Day. By the end of the book, Otter Dana has been attacked by skinheads who beat him for his camera, which he manages to keep clutched to his chest. He's in the hospital in Spain. His friends have come to him, these wonderful friends, and their wonderful language and their ways of not hearing one another. And Arthur begins to cry, which, of course, occasions the usual celebration of speaking. This is Sees Notabum, reading from one of the last sections of All Souls Day.
Let me just add, if I can, to a fragment to the story. He has been unconscious for 2 weeks. He's been in a coma, and he has very, very difficult moments to adjust again to actuality. And then suddenly these friends from Berlin come into this Madrid hospital, and one of them, Victor the sculptor, suddenly and unexpectedly will do a tap dance for him, as it were, to dance him back into life. And then, of course, he has to weep. Arthur weeps. Arthur apologized to the nurse in a kind of sign language for the tears. "It's part of the healing process," she said. "Es completamente natural." There followed a discussion of tears, weeping, and crying. Arno was currently working on an essay about tears in literature. That was a coincidence. What did Nietzsche have to say on the subject? Surely Nietzsche had said something. "He who does not weep is not a genius." "That's what Nietzsche said," said Victor. "I know my proverbs." "Okay, okay. But what about 'I can't distinguish between music and tears'? That's also Nietzsche." "Your time is up, ladies and gentlemen." "In my humble opinion," Arno said, "the last time anyone wept was in Stendhal. Everybody weeps in the Charterhouse of Parma. Duchesses, marquises, countesses, bishops, one big veil of tears. At least Flaubert put a stop to that. No Dutch person would be caught dead weeping in the 20th century. Only Germans still weep." That was Victor. "We Dutch don't weep. We cry. We've been crying since the 20s. In German, you call it heulen, which is more like howling or wailing." "Russians are always wailing," said Zenobia, "except that she pronounced it wailing." He could feel the words gradually slipping away from him. What had he done a moment ago after Victor's tap dance? Had that been weeping or crying? "Russians are always wailing." He could feel now how tired he was. The words kept circling around, wanting to say something to him, but unable to. He waited for the sounds to fade, melt, dissipate, until only a soft, breathy sigh remained, the sound of his own breathing, which was sleep.
Sees Notabum, reading one of the final sections from his novel All Souls Day. Now, Sees, in addition to laughing during that section, I did start to cry because I felt, you know, these voices who, on the subject of tears, cite Nietzsche, yeah, cite Stendhal, praise Flaubert for being unsentimental, these voices are disappearing. And part of the burden of this novel is to ask what we will do in the world after intellectual language has to some extent passed as just another fashion. And I know that you have commented on this, but how in the world will we live in the world without the intellectual poetry that allows us to cope with it?
Yeah, I don't know. There are these moments that you think, well, it will last my time. I've noticed though, on the other hand, this book has been translated now in quite a lot of languages, and I've noted not that the book has been neglected in, for example, America or England. I've got some very good reviews. But the tone of the reviews is very different in France and in Italy. As if this old continent that is, has been so used to suffering. I remember when, after the 11th of September, American friends wrote to me, "This is the end of time." Then I said, "Well, if that's the case, what about Auschwitz, Hiroshima, and Dresden? I mean, we've always the end of time somehow." But make things so definite is also to refuse thinking about it. This whole idea of we must get on is, of course, admirable, and this is the human thing to do. But one should not stop thinking about it in also a philosophical way. What's really happening right now? And I've tried to do that in this book.
Well, in fact, you point out that the historian of the end of history, Hegel, gives us the example, looking at Napoleon. He thinks, this is the end of history. So the history has been coming to the end of history ever since it has been posited that history could have an end.
Yes, Hegel was writing, you know, and he heard the guns at Jena, and he thought, this is it. Now time will be so changed that history as we know it has ended. But then history has this strange way of always beginning anew. And so I would say that Hegel was mistaken. Hegel believed in struggle. He could apparently really not predict what kind of struggle we would have. You know, he really said, and one of the people in this book brings it up, that Hegel has said, "The days of peace are the white pages in the book of history," which is awful in its sense. But he, who thought that struggle was necessary to reach the end of, let's say, complete consciousness for humankind, he could not envisage the kind of horrible wars that we would be facing.
I've been talking with Cees Noteboom, author most recently of All Souls Day, published by Harkot. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can read the first chapter of All Souls Day on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.